You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Richard Cytoic, MD, is the author of The Man Who Tasted Shapes, and his most recent book is Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age. Thank you for joining me, Richard.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
We're here to talk about an article you wrote for bottomline.com. It's called The Art of Doing Nothing, and it's tied intimately to your book. Give us just the overview, flyover version of what your book's about.
Well, it's about why our attention spans have just gone to hell, which everybody agrees on, and what we can do about it. The fact that when people say, I'm addicted to my phone, they really are addicted to their phone. And even when people realize this, they don't know how to unaddict themselves.
Now, one of the things about your book that I like so much, and especially about this article, is this, it's a Danish idea of Nick Sen, The Art of Doing Nothing. And the reason I really like this is because now I come from a very old version of IT. Mm-hmm. When everything was written on hard drives. Now, hard drives were about, you know, the size.
Enormous, yes.
Rather large. And they had a frequency of breaking. And in order to make the hard drives work better and the whole retrieve information from the drives, you do something called an FSCK, file system check.
Yes.
And what this did was to just rearrange the bits that had been used and put on there kind of randomly into a tighter and more coordinated.
Tighten them up, yeah. Yeah. I remember doing that check disk, yes.
All the time. And I think that Nick Sen is the human version of that, or allows for that. And one of the things, your book is about how our evolution on essentially the prairie left us vulnerable to manipulation by screen devices, which triggered the same feelings of fear and, you know, existential danger for, you know, getting a burger, as used to be, you know, trigger us for there's a cheetah that's going to jump on you and eat you.
Exactly, yes.
And I think that one of the things that when we were on the pampas, we were not always on high alert. We couldn't be. And there just wasn't that much to do. And so there would be times, I imagine, when our brains just told us to stop. And though at the time we weren't aware of it, let us reset ourselves, reformat those neurons, and that helped us both survive and evolve.
I say that the brain is, an enormous change detector. So it detects any changes in circumstances, good or bad. And so it always responds to novelty. It's like a squadron leader looking at the radar that says incoming, and it throws everybody on high alert. And that's what happens when we do that, when the brain does that. For long stretches of time in our Stone Age ancestors, conditions didn't change much. I mean, the environment was pretty much the same. The only thing that changed were the seasons and the position of the stars overhead. And everything else is pretty much predictable, except when something out of the ordinary happens. So an acrid smell or a smell of smoke, the snap of a twig, the growl of an animal, all these threw us on high alert. And not just the individual, but the whole community, because early on, we were tight-knit groups. Small groups were tightly bound and rather in the tensely social. And so today we don't have that, but what we have is a technological industry that hires reams of psychologists and neuroscientists who are expertly schooled in how our brains work, and they have designed their platforms, you know, to keep us on them as long as possible. So all the app developers know that there are only 1,440 minutes in a day. And so they compete ruthlessly for our eyeballs, and they want us to stay on the platform as long as possible. And that's how this infinite scroll is so addictive. I mean, we can be scrolling on Instagram or TikTok or X or whatever, and it's, where's the signal to end? Like, if we're eating something, we're eating and it's delicious, but at some point we say, okay, I'm full, I've had enough, I can't eat anymore, okay? But when you're scrolling on your phone, where is the signal that says, you've had enough, stop? Because there isn't such a signal. It's always one more. Let me look a little bit more. Maybe I'll get something, maybe I'll get a hit, maybe something interesting will come up, etc. So there's no signal to put the brakes on.
You know, that's exactly why we need this idea of Nick Sen. And we need to understand it, I think, formally, which is why I like your article, that it posits that doing nothing is actually doing something.
It's doing something, yes.
And also, too, because the cultural forces for against, quote, doing nothing or doing that something that appears like you're doing nothing are incredible. And the pressure to always produce, always be busy, always be doing something is born into us.
Never a still moment. Yeah.
Never a still moment. Talk about the need in the modern age for those still moments and the things that conspire against them. You know, this idea that it's become almost a religion and a morality. And I've actually seen, quotes of people who say that if you're poor, that the poor are poor because they lack the character to, quote, be busy enough to be rich.
Right here, blame the victim. Okay, sure. So, I mean, let me just say, what Nixon is, the art of doing nothing. And it's not really doing nothing, because what it's doing is throwing the circuit breaker on this endless busyness that we have. And so Nixon involves looking out the window, listening to the birds, looking at the clouds. Maybe you'd look how the branches are swaying in the breeze. It doesn't take a hell of a lot of effort to do that. And you don't have to do it for very long. I mean, 3 to 5 minutes is, or an act, 3 minutes is plenty. And what it does is it throws the circuit breaker of all this busyness. You know, some people often say, oh, I'd love to learn how to meditate, and I want to understand what the mind is like. Well, when you first try to meditate, the first thing that you discover is that the mind is this relentless torrent of ideas and judgments and objectifications and arguments, and it just doesn't stop. And so, I mean, I practice what's called Soto Zen, which is the Serene Reflection School of Meditation. And that and other schools, a very common thing for beginners is, well, you sit and you count your breath from 1 to 10, okay? Most people can't make it past 1, because as soon as they do, their mind is off to the races. And it's like, my God, it's like wild horses inside your head. You cannot stop it. And I'm here to tell you that, yes, you can stop it, but it takes practice. Just like, you can't just sit down at the piano and play a beautiful piece. It takes practice to learn how to do that. And so but it strikes most people in the West as weird that you would learn to practice how to control your mind. And yet your mind is with you all the time. So if you can't control it, then who is in control of it? So this mindless activity is really not so mindless as much as it's not focused on the goal-driven busyness. So, for example, a great so-called mindless activity is walking. Just go for a walk and don't take your phone with you, okay? Famous writers were great walkers. Virginia Woolf talked about how on her many, many long walks that these ideas would come to her as if she said it was like bubbles blowing from a pipe. Where did they come from? I don't know. They were just there. Walt Whitman was a great boulevardier, and Nietzsche said, all great thoughts are born while walking. And there's something about this, because walking is really like a physical meditation. You're just one foot in front of the other. You look up at the buildings, at the trees, at the clouds, and all of a sudden, you have a great thought. So I'll tell you, I cheat, actually, because when I go for a walk, I used to carry a little tape recorder with me, but now, of course, it's an iPhone. Because you're walking, and you'll have a great thought. So you pull it out and you dictate what that thought is, because if you don't do it, it's like dreaming. If you don't write the dream down when you wake up and realize you've had a dream, you're never going to remember it. You'll have morning amnesia from it. Same thing goes with many people realize that they have great thoughts when they're in the shower. Why is that? Well, for one thing, you're surrounded, you're in this beautiful warm water, so your tactile sensory input is sort of homogenized.
It's like the womb.
You've got the white noise of the shower, which is blocking off your hearing, and so your mind is free to just wander. And that's what it needs to do, is wandering, a flânerie of the mind.
You know, one of the things that I find when I walk is I walk on the beach every day, and there's one part of the wrecked trailer park, which was wrecked by the storms a few years ago, where there are two restrooms, and I like to walk on the outside of the restrooms so I can be closer to the ocean, and I got back into the road. And when I'm doing that, I can't tell you how many times I've gone past the two restrooms, and I am so much out of myself, I can't remember whether or not I've actually done my little around the corner cutting so I can be closer to the ocean. And I think that's, you know, indicative of where you want to be, so that you do not actually know what you're doing or what you've done just seconds ago. And then I think,
You're not rationally conscious of what you're doing every moment. But lucky you, being near the ocean. Where do you live?
In Aptos. You can look me up by doing a find for the cement boat SS Palo Alto.
Palo Alto, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, being near the ocean too, you've got the sound of the waves. That's another, it's like a tranquility tank. You know, it's the sound of the waves is drowning out everything else, and you've got this deafferentation of all these sensory inputs. And that's really important too. And that's really what meditation does. It's sort of blocking out this sensory bombardment, you know, and you can learn how to do this deliberately and make the distinction between natural thought and deliberate thought. So imagine yourself sitting under a bridge, okay, and you're trying to meditate, and there's cars going by overhead, and you think, oh, there's a Mercedes, there's a BMW, there's a Ford F-150, da, da, da. Well, that's deliberate thought. You're chasing them like a dog chasing a thing. But if you just sit there and let them go by without chasing them, then you're in the realm of natural thought.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you was about places where you might not expect Nixon to happen, but it does. And for me, and I think for many people, it happens when they're driving. If you're driving in someplace you've driven many times or on a long straight road, you'll all of a sudden look up and think, where the heck has my brain been for the past 20 minutes?
Well, you know, driving is what's called an automatic behavior. It's once you learn a route, it just sort of sinks. The routine goes from your brain into your spinal cord, and you just drive that route. And your mind is off wandering. You can listen to the radio, you can listen to audiobooks, or you can just sort of look at the scenery going by. So yes, you're true. That's another area where sort of Nixon automatically happens, is that you're not focused on the task at hand, because the task has become so automatic that your brain is now freed to focus on other things.
And one of the things that you reason, another reason to seek this state of Nixon, is that your brain has a it needs power. It's a finite resource in there.
Yes, and if you spend your this is what surprises most people, is that the brain has a finite energy capacity. And no amount of diet, exercise, Sudoku puzzles, or supplements is ever going to increase that. And so that's why multitasking is a fool's errand. The two of us talking takes up about half of our available bandwidth. And that's why trying to listen to two people talking at the same time becomes impossible, because we've exceeded the buffer that we have on that.
And that's why when one is reading or writing, you want instrumental music, not vocal music, because the vocals, whatever the are, even I would say not song oriented music, because what you want is just that sustrous wave of sound kind of
That tsunami of sound that washes over you. Interestingly, you should mention that. I can listen to with an opera in the background, you know, mm-hmm. for, let's say, the Saturday afternoon Met broadcast, unless it's in German, because I understand it. And if it's in German, I cannot work because the words are distracting me. You're quite right. Maybe if I spoke Italian, it would be much, much more difficult.
Exactly. I think that's why the same is true for me. If I listen to like opera or something like that, I can write, read fine. And that takes me to another question about reading, which I think is a form of directed meditation, very similar state. But rather than focusing on the words that are going through your own mind and trying to reduce that torrent of the monkey mind, you are focused on the page. Talk about what do we know neurologically about reading?
Well, reading, visual reading, activates the auditory lexicon. So as we read, we aren't aware of it, but we're actually activating the as if we're reading aloud the words. So, I mean, that's one thing that goes on. And this is why I think that popular music with lyrics is not a good idea when you're, because it clashes with what you're trying to read.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I can either read a book or listen to somebody singing. And if I hear the singing, I understand the words. Those words are going through my mind without any help. Whereas it takes a bit of effort to look at and do the reading audiovisual conversion.
This is why having the TV on in the background is incredibly distracting. I know there are people, this is astonishing, but it's true, that there are people who cannot stand quiet. And so they have to have the TV on, quote, for background noise all the time. But you've got people yakking all the time. And so I wonder, how can these people even think with all this noise going on in the background? This is funny. You know, when the iPhone first came out, or not even the iPhone, before that we had track phones. And, you know, I would put it up to my ear and I couldn't hear anybody. I couldn't hear the other side because all the noise around me was just distracting. And what happens is that your brain learns how to filter all that out. So now, of course, we can put a smartphone up to our ear and converse quite well without worrying about all the external distractions. And this is because the brain has an incredible amount of top-down influence. It's got hundreds of thousands of neurons that descend on our auditory cells and auditory areas of the brain that suppress the outside noise, and so that we can focus on the channel that we want to focus on, which is the conversation with our friend. But it took me some time to learn how to, for my brain to learn how to do that.
And I guess this brings up, possibly, I'm not sure, how much do you know about tinnitus?
Tinnitus?
Yeah.
Tinnitus. I know as much as there is to know, but I have to say, the answer for tinnitus is, I wish there was better research on it and a better cure for it. But tinnitus, for your listeners don't know, is a ringing in the ears. So it's either a ringing or a whistling or a popping, and it's relentless and it doesn't stop. There's a constant humming, and you can try all sorts of medications and biofeedback, but for most sufferers of tinnitus, it's pretty awful. Many of them often suffer from a loss of hearing, and also from a loss of balance, because it's affecting the cerebellum. So they're staggering and falling down and bumping into things.
That makes sense. I've suffered from tinnitus since I was a child. I remember standing in front of a wall of televisions at a store called White Front when I was like maybe 5 or 6, and I could hear this ringing in my ears. And I thought it was I was hearing something from the TVs. You know, like some.
Did you have a viral illness like mumps as a child?
No, but I did have my tonsils removed at some point.
Because viral illnesses, particularly mumps and measles, can cause it in young children, and not only render them deaf in some cases, but again cause tinnitus as a side effect.
I have it, and I still have it to this day. I've learned to ignore it.
Sympathies. That's the only thing you can do is to learn to ignore it. And that takes, you know, again, it's like learning how to meditate or learning how to chew gum and pat your belly at the same time, you know, but it's a learnable skill, even though it's a frustrating one.
Absolutely. And this takes us to learning how to create space for Nixon. How do we do that? I mean, is it something you just schedule or a decision you make?
Well, I think it's, you know, once you know about it, because most people have never heard of this before. So let's say you're sitting at your computer, which almost 99% of the people do every day, and you just stop and look out the window for a minute. Look at the clouds, see what's going on out there. And that does two things. One is it throws the circuit breaker off, but also it changes your ocular focus. So now you're not focused in the near point on your screen, but you're focused far away, 20 feet away. And that allows your ciliary muscles in your eye, in your iris, to relax. And that is also beneficial because this having them scrunched up all the time is exhausting and can lead to headaches and all that. So start with that. Look out the window and say, okay, fine, I'm going to take 30 seconds and do this. And then go back to your work and see what happens. And you might be surprised that all of a sudden your focus is so much better. You know, often when we have problems that we're focused on and we're hammering away at them, the best thing is to just let it all go. There's a wonderful Chinese saying that do nothing and everything is done. And so if you allow yourself to have a break from trying to solve this problem, like going to take a walk for 3 or 5 minutes, all of a sudden you may realize that the solution is in front of you now, whereas before you couldn't see it.
You know, I just experienced that exact thing where I was like hammering it away, trying to figure out how to configure my electronic music studio. I just could not get a sound out of it. I spent like 4 hours trying everything I could figure out, making every query I could, and then I finally just gave up. I came back the next morning. I figured it out in like 3 minutes.
Which is the same reason why a good night's sleep will solve a lot of problems. You know, just stop trying to solve it and just go to bed. There's an artist colony I go to in Amherst, Virginia. It's halfway between Charlottesville and Lynchburg. And there's 10 visual artists, 10 writers, 3 composers. And it's a beautiful estate. And there's cows and horses. And so, you know, you're working all morning long after breakfast, and people, you can see your fellow artists, they're taking a break. And so they get up and they go walk around the driveway or go around the property or whatever, or just take a look at the cows. And that's a mental break from the problems that they're working on. And so when they, you know, take a deep breath or we've had lunch, and we go back, all of a sudden, like, oh, I see. Well, I see what to do. I see what's gone wrong. I see what needs to be fixed. You know, and that's a wonderful gift.
And too, one of the things you point out is that Nixon gives you a chance to experience creativity, which is something that's entirely internal. And yes. The only way, and it makes perfect sense, and, you know, you usually think that I'm going to get all my tools out and manipulate them and I'll find creativity there. And it only happens once you are no longer aware of your tool or aware of what you're doing.
And you're not really trying.
Yeah, you're entered the state of what's called flow. But also, you can just sit there and ignore your tools and wait for that creativity to happen within. And I think that's a really important lesson from this article.
I think, yes, and this, the allowing yourself to have these moments of, quote, doing nothing allows the imagination, not the mind to wander, but the imagination to wander. And it's the same thing as, you know, having a great thought in the shower or the bathtub or while taking a walk. These are all related because they're all areas where you've allowed your rational mind to switch off for a moment and allow natural thought to arise. You know, well, Pascal said, you know, reason, but, you know, reason is just the endless paperwork of the mind. So I think rationality is highly overrated. Not to say that we're totally emotional, but we have to appreciate that there's a balance and that we need to let ourselves be in that creative space, trusting that creative moment's going to come to us. Because I know how to do this; I've done this for, my God, decades. So I know that if I just allow the process to happen, that I'm going to see the solution. I'm going to see the solution to this creative problem that I've set up for myself. And part of it also is that you never know what's you know you can't go into it with expecting what's going to happen. I mean, if I knew what I wanted to say when I started out to write a book, I would have no interest whatsoever because I already know it. But the writing is solving a puzzle. And as I write, I am discovering what I think and what I want to say. And finally, when the words click down, I think, oh, yes, that's it. Yes, that's what I meant. Okay. And you just keep going with it.
I must say that the writing in Stone Age and in this article is just really wonderful. You know, it's more than just telling us the facts. It tells us the facts in a way that's, you know, it hits you harder by virtue of the art. And the art is something that you really cannot explain.
This is actually a writer's trick called psychic distance. And part of it has to do with the fact that I've been a teacher for so long, is that when I write textbooks, for example, I wanted the student to feel that I'm over their shoulder, urging them on, encouraging them. They hear me whispering in their ears, yes, you can do this, you've got this, come on. So part of it is that. But the other part is just, this was such enormous fun to write. It really was, because I was discovering what I thought about all this. And when I started, I don't know, 5 years ago, my agent said, you're going to write a prescriptive book. I thought, okay. I thought, God, these phones, these devices, they're driving me crazy. You know, I'm so, there's such an interruption. And I thought, well, this could be an interesting point of view to take. And that's how I started. And then I realized that so many other people were thinking this way, not at first, but as each year went on, I realized that more and more people were on this bandwagon. So I thought, well, I had a good idea way back, so let's cash in on it and finalize it.
You talk about mindfulness, and Nixon is similar to mindfulness, but not the same. So discuss the similarities and difference between Nixon and mindfulness.
Yeah, they're like cousins in a way. The mindfulness is being aware of what you're doing while you're doing it. The Buddha says, eat when you eat, walk when you walk, die when you die, which means you pay attention to what you're doing with everything. And these are all human experiences. And so if you're flitting about mindlessly from one thing to another, you're not being mindful about anything. And so there's that kind of mindfulness. There's things like walking or working meditations. So chopping vegetables or washing the dishes can be a kind of meditation, because you're totally focused on what you're doing and you're not letting the rational mind just jump ahead and race to wherever it wants to go. You're sort of reining that in. There's the tarot card of the charioteer, where the charioteer's got two horses, they're pulling them in different directions. Well, that's reason and emotion. That's reason and emotion, you know? And so we have to learn to, when do we let rationality take charge, and when do we let go and let emotion take charge? And I think that most people don't know anything about letting go. Again, do nothing and everything is done.
You know, I'm going to ask you a question about one of my kind of odd personal experiences. This has developed over the past 5 years. I've been doing a weekly soundtrack for a show about dreams. It's 1 hour. And the host at one time said, Rick, why don't you just play for a solid hour? I just go, well, that's a really weird idea. I guess I could try to do that. And I've done that since. And I find that when I do that, a couple things happen. When I start, you know, I try to erase all my presets and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's just completely improvised, made up from that moment on. It takes me a little while to get in. And then two things happen. On one hand, I enter a flow state, if I'm lucky, and I kind of don't know what I'm doing. But on the other hand, there's part of my brain, the rational part of my brain, is just saying, oh, this is just terrible. What? You're going to have to redo this whole thing. So, you know, I'll play for an entire hour and think, oh my God, I'm going to have to do this again. And I think, well, I'll just listen to it. And
then the critic is on in the back of your head. Yeah.
Yeah. But then when I listen to it, I think, wow, what the heck was I doing? Why did I think the sound is so terrible? Because it's, you know, I think, well,
it's not. Because it's coming from you, and which is why it's so good. I'll go back and look at some of my books, even the textbooks, which are, you know, pretty technical and all that. And I'll look at a paragraph and I'll read it and I thought, who the hell wrote this? I don't remember writing this. This is really good. Where'd this come from? And this is something that all creative people will tell you, is that they feel that the best part of themselves comes from a part of themselves that they don't control. Yeah. So
okay.
What external people attribute as uniquely them, they don't see it. I don't see it. And people say, oh, you write so well. It's like, I do, really? What did I? So I think my friend, my writer friends and my visual artists and my composer friends, they all say this, that when they're in the state of flow, that God knows what's taking over them, but they just let it go and let her rip. And I think that's what you're alluding to in that example that you just gave.
One of the things that you need to do if you want to experience a Nixon is set boundaries. You write about this. Tell us about how to do that in a way that also allows us to pay the bills.
Pay the bills? Well, I mean, as I said, first you can just sort of realize that, you know, get up from your computer screen and look out the window for two or three minutes. That's all it takes. But then you want to maybe start setting boundaries. So for me, my boundaries are, I mean, I get an ungodly amount of emails and texts and all that. And so I look at it at 4 a.m. I get up between 4 and 5 a.m. every day. So I look at it at 4 a.m. and then not again until 4 p.m. Because by 5, I want to have a cocktail and I don't want to be bothered by any of this stuff. And so I think the point is, what could be so important that I have to be available every minute of the day? If friends or family want to reach me, they know how to reach me. And if external people want to email me and reach me or get me on LinkedIn or whatever, they'll be able to do it, but not immediately. I'll get back to you. I don't leave people waiting for days, but it's going to be 24 hours if you don't hit me in that window when I am available to look. Because otherwise, you know, my office hours are not infinite. I'm not at the beck and call of everybody's demands. Because you can't. You drive yourself crazy doing that. So that's one way to set limits, first of all. And then, what do I like doing? Well, I like binging Netflix, which I just did Saturday night. I like reading. So the Economist comes on Fridays. And so I want to sit down with my cocktail and read the Economist. I don't want to be disturbed by other things. Forget it. This is my sacrosanct time. And everything else will take care of itself, you know? You don't have to be available 24/7 every second of the day. And this is one of the awful things about being work, where bosses demand that you be available to answer your emails and your texts and all that. You know, bosses would really do everybody a favor by saying, you know, if they want to send out an email on the weekend or Sunday night and all that, you know, say, you do not need to respond to this until Monday at 10 a.m. But here's what I want to know. But, you know, you don't need to respond now.
We all need bosses like you, Richard.
I know. If only they'd be canonized.
Now, you also suggest that we need to reframe our relationship with productivity. And I think this is a really important thing to do. It's something that you can actually, you know, this is a task that you can put on your checklist. And that's important in a world where you're surrounded by people who want you to be ready to do some task 24/7.
Oh, now. Yeah. Answer me now. Why haven't you answered my text? Well, you only sent it 1 minute ago. So what do you expect?
Right. So how do we reframe our relationship with productivity?
With productivity? Well, what does it mean to be productive?
Exactly.
You have to answer that for yourself. If it means being at the beck and call of everybody who disturbs you and wants your attention, then you're just being a fool. you're not being productive at all. You're being a slave to other people's demands. And so productivity means, how can I channel my time best so that I get done what I want to get done? Let's say I have a plan for a project or a presentation or some artistic work, you know, how am I going to accomplish that if I don't, if I don't sequester time for it, to do it, and I have to guard time for me to do that kind of stuff. And that means saying no. I have another book. It's actually in my published manuscript. It's called How to Say No. And this grew out of, something I was dissatisfied with. We were, be out with people, and then somebody would decide, oh, let's invite X, Y, and Z, the more the merrier, and then, or you're at a dinner thing, well, let's split everything. It's like, no, I ordered this. This is what I want to eat. But no, they take your plate away, they share it, and when it comes back to you, there's nothing left. It's like, I don't want to deal with these people. And so, you know, that's when I learned to how to say, thank you, but I'm going someplace else. Goodbye. And because I didn't want to be with them. And that took some doing. And it really had an effect on other people, too, because other people felt trapped by these do-gooders with good intentions. But, you know, they just wanted to hijack stuff for their own ends. And I wouldn't allow people to do that. And so that's when I started learning how to say no.
You know, who came to a similar conclusion many years ago. Herman Melville wrote a story.
Really?
Bartleby the Scrivener.
Oh, yes, yes.
And his motto, and my motto too, is, I would prefer not to.
I would prefer not to.
So there's now, yeah. You also talk about challenge the fear of missing out. And once again, I'm going to bring a little personal experience to this. I have my electronic music studio behind me, and I have tons of gear. And every time a new piece of gear comes out, you get what's called GAS, gear acquisition syndrome. So you just say, I've got to have that. It's just so cool. And then you get in there and you go, oh my God. And you know, sometimes that, you know, got to have it pays off, and you get a piece of gear and you go, well, this is pretty transformative. I'm glad I've got that. How do you, where do you experience your own version of GAS, and how do you control it, the fear of missing out?
Well, the gas, yeah, like, oh, this looks so good. I've got to have it. Let's get this on Amazon, or let's order this. And it's like, do I, you know, so yes, put it in your cart, but wait to check out for another day. And then tomorrow you'll say, do I really need this? Do I really want to spend $39.95 on this thing? Do I have time to learn how to deal with this new piece of software or gadget or whatever? And again, it's like having a good night's sleep on something, is that in the morning, what seemed like such a pressing problem isn't that pressing anymore. And so that can, I think, can temper your gasp syndrome. And the other fear of missing out. Well, that hits at a very, very ancient circuit of ours in the amygdala, is that we the fear of losing something is much more powerful than the pleasure of gaining something. And this is why you know, people don't like to lose money in the stock market or in a gamble or on a sports bet and all that. It really feels terrible. And compared to, let's say, I won $120 in the lottery scratch-off ticket. Well, that's nice, but, you know, it's nothing like, I just lost $20 on this stupid Powerball thing. So it's a strong, strong evolutionary thing that we do not like to lose things. So that's where FOMO comes in. And then the question is, okay, I might want to lose, maybe I don't want to lose this, but why don't I wait until tomorrow and see how I feel about it? Let's sleep on it.
You know, that's good advice. And that brings up, I've actually done that with, I host an electronic music show. So every week I look and see, is there some new thing I want to buy to play on the show? And last time I look at it and I listen to the samples and think, well, maybe I want this or not, but I'll just put it in my wish list. And so I've got a wish list that's like 10 miles long, and every single one of them I look at, and I'm like, what was I thinking? This sounds terrible.
You know, as I get older, I realize I've got too much stuff. And, you know, I try to go through a section of the house and just look and then throw things out, and put them in the goodwill bin kind of thing. When my husband died, he used to take care of the outside of the house when we had beautiful, beautiful gardens. So it's like, oh, now I have to take care of these. What am I going to do? And I didn't really know, but I would, you know, look at the spots and I thought, well, I'll plant perennials. And then I would see some what I thought were bare spots, and I would plant something there, only to have something come up that I didn't realize was there. And then I became obsessed with all these catalogs. I thought, oh, this looks good, this looks good. And I would by buying all these bulbs and stuff. I mean, I would be planting 50, 75 bulbs at a time. I had an auger when a drill would, you know, drill holes for it. And it's finally like, I have to stop. I have no more dirt left to plant anything in. It's like I become obsessed with this. And so, you know, initially, I thought, okay, I'll do the work for this season, next season, and then I can step back and relax because they're perennials that keep coming up and keep coming up and coming up. I don't have to do anything anymore. And so that's where I am now. But, you know, these catalogs come, and it's like, do I really want to look through this catalog, or should I just throw it in the trash now?
Could you tell me, what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a suspense thriller called What She Saw, and it's a collaboration with one of my old MFA colleagues. She's a little bit older than me, and we spent some time together at VCCA, the artist colony I mentioned, and we're nearly finished, but it's a book of it involves an inventor, a professor, a very sick young girl who's dying, synesthesia, and an awful, evil man, and murder. Other than that, it's like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. It's like a very cheerful story. But that's what we're working on. It's a suspense thriller.
That's fantastic. And what I'd like to ask you is, talk about collaborating with somebody on a creative project. It must be very different from, the stuff, the other works you've written, or
I
is
don't know.
it?
I love to collaborate. I've collaborated on academic papers. I've collaborated with David Eagleman on Wednesday's Indigo Blue. And interesting, you know, Barbara, my co-author on What She Saw, is a playwright, and she's got this musical that's currently being table read in London and all that. And she just, you know, she says, oh, the composer's driving her crazy. The book, all her co-author collaborators they're at odds and fighting. And she said, when she looked at me, she said, you are the best thing to work with. You're so easy, you know? So I like doing that. I also have I'm currently the scientific advisor for a screenwriter in Los Angeles who's just been greenlit for his project. It's the Piano Wire Murderer. Which stars the protagonist as a Palestinian psychologist who is so good at what he does because he has synesthesia, And so he was this the writer was telling me, he says that the production company was really interested to hear that I was the scientific advisor. So so that's been an absolute wonderful collaboration. And it's so rewarding to help younger people to who are creative to achieve something that they've always dreamed of. So that's just, I take a parental pride in the fact that he's gotten this far.
Well, synesthesia to me seems like a topic that's made to be put up on the screen. And I, because it involves movies are synesthetic experience. They're,
Sure they
you
are.
see them and you hear them. And those are our two primary modes of input. Have you ever done research on movies versus, I guess, reading as a means of, getting input?
Well, I mean, most people, when they hear about synesthesia, they say, "Oh, that's interesting. That's so unusual." But they don't realize that most people are synesthetic all the time. That's why even sight and sound are so tightly bound already that it never occurs to us that we're lip reading every time we're talking to somebody, except when we're at a very loud cocktail party and we really have to concentrate and look at their mouth to see what they're saying so we can hear it. Cinema is another classic example where the sound is coming from the speakers behind us and around us, whereas we think that it's coming from the mouths on the of the actors on screen. Dance is another synesthetic experience where sound rhythms and physical rhythms match one another. That's why foot tapping, you can't help but tap your foot when the music's really good. So yeah, so there is a It, the question isn't, do synesthetes have crosstalk among the senses? The question is, how much crosstalk do they have? Because we all have crosstalk, except we never think that it's strange that we have to look at somebody to understand what they're saying. Whereas when people say, "Oh, I see music, I have colored hearing, I have this, that, the other," is then we say, "Oh, that's really strange." But it's not strange at all. It's just different. And synesthetes have a different texture of reality, and they have much more. They have more, much more robust connections among the senses than the rest of us do. And so that's why we're not conscious of them, whereas synesthetes are conscious of these connections.
The new book by Richard Cytulic, MD, is Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age. He's also the author of The Man Who Tasted Shapes and with David Eagleman, Wednesday is Indigo Blue. Thank you for joining me, Richard. This has been a delight.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's good to talk with you again.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.